Now, shall we begin?
You know, one of the things that LaVoy's wife has said to me when she appeared on the show was that she believes that LaVoy pulled his car off to the left into the snowbank and got out immediately because he wanted to protect you, the other female that was in the car, and Ryan Bundy. Do you agree with that?
100%. Yes, I do.
I was not surprised with the outcome of that press conference or how it was conducted, and how the media group that was specifically handpicked, like cherry-picking and allowed there, did not ask any hard questions.
We learn everything that is necessary about the priorities of the federal government in the matter of the shooting of LaVoy Finicum, in the fact that a federal judge has ordered a witness to remain silent rather than ordering the FBI agents involved in that killing to tell the truth. A federal judge Tuesday agreed to lift Shauna Cox's home detention and replace it with a curfew, but cautioned the 59-year-old defendant in the armed takeover of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge not to make public comments about the pending case, reported the Oregonian newspaper on March 29th. She's not going to make any public comment at all, period, or she could sit in jail, U.S. District Judge Robert E. Jones ordered. Cox has been out of custody since her January 29th release and listened to Tuesday's hearing via speakerphone from her home in Kanab, Utah. The judge told Cox that she must refrain from making any comments by phone or social media about her case or any future protest movements. None of these conditions, it should be pointed out, was imposed upon her at the time of her original release in January. Tiffany Harris, Cox's lawyer, objected to the scope of the order, but said her client would abide as if she had any choice. Cox is one of 27 people facing federal indictments stemming in the refugee takeover. It began January 2nd and lasted 41 days. Ammon Bundy said he led the occupation to protest the return to prison of two Harney County ranchers and the federal control of public lands. I'm beginning to suspect that the Malheur Refuge case, which of course now has commingled with the Bunkerville, Nevada case, or the case emerging from the Bunkerville standoff in April of 2014, is going to become the third great sedition trial in American history. There was a sedition trial of people who were somewhat loosely associated as critics of FDR and the U.S. war effort during World War II. Francis Biddle famously tried to put these people on trial as a way of suppressing any dissenting voices regarding the actions of the FDR regime that culminated in American involvement in World War II. And he wanted to define sedition so broadly that anybody who had ever criticized the New Deal could be treated as if he were a seditionist. The second great sedition trial dealt with a much nastier cast of characters. This was the Fort Smith sedition trial of several dozen people who were loosely connected through the white nationalist movement, Lewis Beam and Company. And this ended with most of the people who had not yet been convicted of other crimes. That was a trial that actually involved legitimate crimes, such as murder, the murder of Alan Berg, a really unpleasant radio personality from Denver who was gunned down by people associated with the Bruderschweigen, the so-called Silent Brotherhood, which was a white supremacist bank robbery gang. There had been another murder involving somebody who was suspected of being an informant for the FBI, and there were multiple bank robberies in which property was stolen and property was damaged, and people had been convicted of civil rights violations. But in the case of the murder of Alan Berg and the other hapless fellow who had been an informant, there was never a murder prosecution because the priority of the regime was to prosecute offenses against the government rather than offenses against persons and property. Those are the tort priorities of people who believe that the most important thing in the universe is to maintain the supposed legitimacy of the federal government. And many of the people, many of the figures who'd been involved in this sedition trial had already been convicted of other offenses. And many of those convictions emerged from an enterprise crime model in which the Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, or RICO statute, was used for the first time in American history to prosecute people who were considered part of a seditious political movement, in this case, once again, the admittedly detestable white supremacist movement. The fact that their politics are detestable doesn't mean that their politics should be criminalized. Overt, discrete acts of violence against persons and property are crimes irrespective of political motivation, and crimes of that sort were involved in this so-called seditious conspiracy. But the federal government tried to turn this into a political prosecution, and this occurred during the Reagan administration, significantly. This was part of an FBI program called Operation Clean Sweep, which eventually begat, in my opinion, on the basis of the evidence I've seen, the Patriot Conspiracy or PATCON operation, which began in the late 1980s. And eventually brought us the so-called Aryan Republican Army, which was an FBI-controlled and FBI-manipulated white supremacist bank robbery gang, which involved many of the same cast of characters that you had seen in the Operation Clean Sweep crackdown, and which was deeply entangled in the Oklahoma City bombing. And the PATCON operation, I'm convinced, is continuing even to this day, and perhaps there are elements of that that we will eventually find played a role in what's happened at Bunkerville and at the Malheur Refuge, such as the use of an FBI informant or informants. And that is a matter about which Shawna Cox has been very voluble. She was in the back seat when Lavoie Finicum drove into the kill box that had been established by the FBI's hostage rescue team on Highway 395. She gave an account immediately after being released from pretrial detention that in every particular has been validated by the video that she captured during the incident and the video that had been provided by the FBI surveillance airplane of the shooting of Lavoie Finicum. She told the truth. The first person who provided an account of what happened at Highway 395 was not in the vehicle, was not an immediate eyewitness to those events, and his version of the story was perfectly calibrated to make the actions of the government look reasonable. He was arrested at that roadblock, at the first part of that roadblock, not at the second part of the roadblock where the shooting took place. He was carrying a firearm, and yet he was released without charges. Shawna Cox, in her interviews with members of the independent media, has referred to this individual as an FBI asset in place, an informant, a provocateur. And that's most likely the reason why she's now subject to a gag order. The FBI's hostage rescue team, as has now been demonstrated by the Oregon State Police investigation, fired at least two shots at Finicum as he emerged from the vehicle with his hands up. The only purpose for doing so would have been to execute him as he was surrendering. It was after this happened that he took his hands down and made the furtive gesture that resulted in his killing. And the FBI immediately conspired to cover up the evidence of those illegal shots. Once again, the priority of the federal government here is not to compel the FBI's HRT operators to tell the truth about what they did at the ambush on Highway 395, but rather to suppress the public statements of a witness who not only told the truth about the actions of the FBI at that roadblock, but also identified somebody who was most likely at present in the protective custody of the FBI because he had been an asset in place who helped precipitate the murderous roadblock and ambush on Highway 395. According to the Oregonian, Cox has been indicted on two charges: federal conspiracy to impede officers at the wildlife refuge through intimidation, threats, or force, and possession of firearms in a federal facility. Shortly after her release, Cox was allowed to attend Finicum's funeral in Kanab. Otherwise, she was ordered placed on GPS monitoring, home detention that permitted her to leave home only for work, medical appointments, religious services, or other activities permitted by a pretrial services officer. She also isn't permitted to possess any firearms and can only travel to Oregon for court. Assistant U.S. Attorney Craig Gabriel said Tuesday that Cox, quote, has incited people to travel to Montana to help in harboring co-defendant Jake Ryan, who has not yet been arrested. Cox also went on a YouTube video on March 23rd for more than an hour talking about the pending case and who she believed to be a government informant, Gabriel said. They're protecting their snitch. And they're defining the terms of this prosecution so broadly that practically anybody who has said something favorable about the protest occupation, who has defended the actions of the occupiers, or who has been critical of the federal government's handling of this matter, could be labeled a seditionist. As I said, I think what they're trying to do is put together the groundwork for the third great sedition trial in American history. And in this case, the only so-called crime was the admittedly ill-conceived and somewhat damaging occupation of abandoned federal property. I'll have a lot more to say about this when I get back from the break. This is Will Grigg with Freedom's Other Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network. Stand by for more sedition after this.
Do you have numbers for people here in town?
Yeah, but...
Hey,
okay,
they're shooting.
Hey,
I'm. Okay,
we're
here.
Go ahead and shoot me.
Damn. Stay down. Stay down. Stay down. Stay down. Stay down. Stay down. Damn it. Are they shooting him? Did they shoot him?
So we went down, and it was a big dramatic stage with all the Ames standing there with their looking really macho with their, but they had poles, pipes and things, and they were standing guard. After we got in the building, we found that there was no one negotiating any place. So I said, well, do you have someone that you've talked to that you can negotiate with? And I'll help you. We'll see if we can use Fred's office and help you set up the meetings.
But then when we started talking, then a fight broke out in the back. The police tried to charge the building.
Cops had decided to storm the building. There was a lot of stuff being thrown around inside and table legs used as clubs and stuff like that. And the cops were attempting to come in some of the lower windows. And the guys were down there beating them back with those table legs.
I've been accused of trivializing the occupation of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge outside of Burns, or perhaps understating the grievous nature of this offense, supposedly. By way of putting this in perspective, I would like to recall what happened in November of 1972, when hundreds of activists associated with the American Indian Movement, at the culmination of their nationwide protest march called the Trail of Broken Treaties, and they certainly had a very lengthy and very compelling list of legitimate grievances. The AIM cadres, many of them heavily armed, seized control of the Washington, D.C. headquarters of the Bureau of Indian Affairs and held it for a week. The occupiers assaulted law enforcement officers, blew open a safe, seized documents, ignored judicial orders to vacate the premises. At one point, they held hostage a police officer, eventually releasing him with no additional injury. They issued a list of demands to the federal government and eventually did an estimated $2 million worth of damage to the facility. At the time, as a matter of fact, the Nixon administration, which exercised restraint for reasons of political advantage, said that the damage done to the BIA headquarters in Washington, D.C., in terms of its financial impact, was eclipsed only by the damage done by the San Francisco earthquake. In other words, this is a very consequential occupation that resulted in a great deal of very expensive damage. Yet, the protesters were allowed to leave without being arrested. This happened after two separate occupations of federal territory, specifically Alcatraz Island, which had been guaranteed to various Indian tribes through solemn treaties and eventually had been turned into one of the most notorious prisons in the American prison system. During the second and very lengthy occupation of Alcatraz, there was at least one death that occurred. It wasn't investigated as a murder. It was almost certainly an accident, but there was loss of life during that occupation. You had a steady parade of very high-profile celebrities to Alcatraz. It became something of a pilgrimage for people from Hollywood and people from the political establishment in California. And once again, they held at defiance the federal government and local and state police. No arrests ensued because of the Alcatraz occupation or the subsequent occupation of the BIA. Within about a year and a half of the 1972 occupation of the BIA office by members of the American Indian Movement, there was the much larger and deadlier occupation at Wounded Knee, and that resulted in criminal trials. And most of those put on trial, with the exception of Leonard Peltier, I believe, were acquitted. And during that occupation, the supposed hostages in the nearby town actually expressed sympathy with the American Indian activists. This resulted in a full-scale military mobilization by the FBI and by elements of the United States Armed Forces. It was probably the largest domestic mobilization of the military since MacArthur suppressed the bonus marchers back in the 1930s. But to focus once again on the question of what happened at the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge, the regime has been emitting photographs recently showing how the occupiers supposedly trashed the place and disturbed sacred land containing artifacts which are esteemed by the local Paiute Indians. I don't know whether any of the latter would be true. I rather doubt that it would be. It's useful to underscore and italicize the fact that they did nowhere near as much damage to these vacant and poorly maintained facilities at the remote Malheur National Wildlife Refuge than the American Indian activists had done in downtown Washington, D.C., to the national headquarters of a pretty significant element of the Department of Interior. I'm not trying to say that it is ever a good idea to occupy property that doesn't belong to you. And of course, it doesn't legitimately belong to the federal government. A government cannot legitimately own property, as I tirelessly point out. I'm not trying to say that what they did in the occupation of the Malheur Wildlife Refuge was wise or tactically sound. What I'm saying is that many of the same people on the left who have denigrated the Bundys and their associates as domestic terrorists akin to ISIS. One very popular sobriquet hung around the neck of these people was Y'al-Qaeda. Many of the same people on the left who wanted a drone strike to be carried out in order to obliterate Ammon Bundy and his associates have venerated the AIM. I am very sympathetic with much of what the AIM did, not with everything they did. I don't think that aim shopping, as they called it, which was the practice of barging into convenience stores and other retail stores and simply grabbing things off the shelves and claiming these goods as reparations for the injustices that have been visited upon their ancestors and the injustices that were still being inflicted upon them when they were consigned to the reservations. I'm not trying to say that that was a good thing. Of course, it was not. That's plunder. That's theft. That's violence. That's aggression. That's entirely worthy of contempt and condemnation. Their grievances, of course, with respect to the way that they were being treated by the federal government were legitimate. The federal government had never kept any of the treaties that it had signed in all apparent sobriety and sincerity with the various Indian communities. And American Indians are living in conditions in the United States even today that are comparable to what you find in such blighted lands as Haiti and communist Cuba. So I'm entirely sympathetic to the fact that these people have been treated very badly by precisely the same federal agencies that are now actively seeking to dispossess rural Americans, ranchers, farmers, loggers, miners, people who make productive use of lands that the federal government claims without constitutional warrant or moral justification. It is an abiding source of frustration to me that there have been so few efforts made by people in the land rights movement to court the Indians in Nevada, in Oregon, in Idaho, and elsewhere. Some of the people involved in the Malheur occupation had made overtures to Indian groups in Arizona and Nevada and elsewhere. And as I've pointed out previously, the Western Shoshone in Nevada were treated abominably by the Interior Department and by the BLM. And long before the BLM sent its myrmidons to try to seize the cattle of Cliven Bundy, they were doing exactly the same thing with Raymond Yole and the Dan family, who are Western Shoshones whose lands had been seized by the BLM the same way that the BLM was targeting the Bundys. I will note once again that there were Indians present at Bunkerville, Nevada, in April of 2014, some of them associated with the still active American Indian movement. And I found that to be heartening, albeit in a somewhat bittersweet fashion given the circumstances. One of the things that those who presume to rule us have excelled at is herding Americans into little collectivist cliques and then setting us off against each other, encouraging us to look at each other with suspicion lest we take the time to communicate with each other and realize that the real enemy consists of the people who have herded us into these little reservations. I'll be back in just a minute.
Because there, in my opinion, a Mr. Finnegan was murdered at the hands of the Oregon State Police, and this man was trying to surrender. It's quite obvious on the video that he was trying to surrender, but yet they chose violence and murder rather than to apprehend him. I've driven that route many times, and they had plenty of opportunity to apprehend him, if you will, for lack of a better term, or to question him anywhere along that route, but instead they chose to employ an ambush. Now, I have 24 years in the military, special ops community. I'm a former Army Ranger. I know what an ambush is. And when I saw that video, that was clear cut ambush. I've employed ambushes like that in foreign countries. I know what that's like.
There is a startling omission in a newly released official incident report on the shooting death of Lavoie Finnegan that has reopened controversy over a key figure in the Oregon standoff with federal authorities, wrote my former associate William F. Jasper in a March 16th article for the New American Magazine. Recent Facebook postings by supporters of the occupation point to the conspicuous exclusion of this individual's name in the 360-page report released last week as further evidence that he is the informant and rat who betrayed Finnegan, Ammon Bundy, and the other occupiers. He has been described in numerous news stories as Ammon Bundy's bodyguard. He was regarded by many inside and outside of the 41-day occupation of the Malheur National Wildlife Sanctuary in Oregon as one of the activists in charge of security for the occupiers. On the afternoon of January 26th, he was the driver of the lead vehicle carrying Ammon Bundy and another fellow occupier, Brian Buddha Cavalier. Ironically, I met Mr. Cavalier and he had a round head. Some of you might understand that allusion. To a meeting with the sheriff of neighboring Grant County, accusers say he was knowingly leading Bundy and Cavalier, as well as the following vehicle driven by Arizona rancher Lavoie Finnegan, into a deadly trap. Welcome back, by the way, to Freedom Zealot Radio. I'm William Grigg, and in addition to producing this podcast and sundry other undertakings, I am the author and the proprietor of the Pro Libertate blog. You can find that at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. I publish once or twice a week as my schedule permits. The essays are usually about 2,000 words in length. There's a PayPal button at the bottom of every page, and at the right-hand margin of the page, there's also a Bitcoin button. If you could send some help, I would really appreciate it. The name of the suspected informant is Mark McConnell. He is identified in various news accounts as a 37-year-old truck driver from Buckeye, Arizona, after Lavoie Finnegan was shot to death at an Oregon State Police FBI roadblock. McConnell was arrested along with the other surviving occupants of the two vehicles. Ammon Bundy, Ryan Bundy, Brian Cavalier, Ryan Payne, Shauna Cox, and Victoria Sharp. Victoria Sharp is an 18-year-old whose only role in this was that she had been asked to sing at the abortive town hall meeting in John Day, Oregon. The very last image on the video of that traffic stop is of that 18-year-old girl, palsied with terror, emerging from the vehicle, this Dodge truck, with her hands raised as her forehead and chest are painted with laser targets from the assault weapons being trained upon her by Oregon State police troopers. However, shortly after being taken into custody, Sharp and McConnell were released. Sharp's early release is understandable. She is an 18-year-old minor and was involved only as a member of the Sharp family singers, who briefly provided moral support to the occupiers by singing hymns and patriotic songs. McConnell, however, is a different story, continues Mr. Jasper. McConnell was considered a ringleader of sorts by various witnesses and supporters who had been to the Oregon occupation and were interviewed by the New American. He had been deeply involved in all the activities for which his fellow occupiers are being charged with multiple felonies and federal conspiracy crimes. And, according to one former occupier we interviewed, who was asked to remain anonymous, McConnell was the only occupant of the two vehicles who was wearing a loaded sidearm at the time of the arrest on January 26th. Incidentally, having read that 360-page report, it seems to me very clear, on the basis of the testimony of the still unnamed officers from the OSP, that this was the case, that McConnell was the only one carrying a firearm. And what I find really interesting is that one of the officers interviewed by the OSP as part of this investigation said that there was never any question that the lead vehicle was going to comply with the roadblock and surrender to the police. However, it became very clear that the vehicle driven by Lavoie Finicum was going to be problematic. At one point, according to this officer, he radioed ahead to the secondary roadblock, which was a V-shaped obstruction created by FBI vehicles and then ringed by people in tactically advantageous positions alongside the road. The officer radioed ahead and said, "We're going to have to shoot him." They never had any misgivings about the cooperative disposition of the driver of the first vehicle. It was the same Mr. McConnell. This claim is reinforced by testimony from the arresting officer, identified only as Officer 7, in the recently released official report of the shooting conducted by a Tri-County Major Incident Team composed of investigators from three Oregon County Sheriff's Offices. Although Officer 7's testimony concerns only McConnell's vehicle, other statements released by officials thus far indicate that while there were firearms recovered from Finicum's vehicle, none of the other occupants was carrying or wearing a firearm. Officer 7 was asked by the incident investigators if any occupants of the lead vehicle, McConnell's Jeep, were armed when arrested. Officer 7 responds on page 211, "Yes, the only person that I observed with a weapon, what I recall, was the driver. I recall seeing, I believe he had a pistol on his right hip." That would be a reference to Mark McConnell, elaborates Bill Jasper. The driver. Yet, not only was McConnell released without charge, his name does not even appear among those arrested in the 360 pages of the report. It may have been redacted in some of the many portions of the report that are blacked out. However, there are other portions of the report where the arrestees are listed where there are no redactions, and yet his name is mysteriously absent. On page 358, for instance, we read, quote, "Persons arrested at the scene were Ammon Bundy, Ryan Payne, Brian Cavalier, Shauna Cox, and a juvenile female. Thus, all participants are mentioned, with even a reference to Victoria Sharp, a minor, except for the key player, McConnell." This conspicuous absence from the official report reinforces earlier evidence that McConnell, while posing as a patriot activist, was actually working as an informant for the FBI and or other federal agencies. His quick release following the initial arrest on January 26th was almost certainly intended to enable him to produce a video that would contradict and neutralize the testimony of Victoria Sharp, who was providing an up-close and personal eyewitness account of the Finicum shooting in radio and video interviews that were going viral on the internet. And according to some critics, contrary to McConnell's claims that he independently filmed the video, the evidence is persuasive that it was actually filmed by and for the FBI. The McConnell video was a huge boon for the FBI and other law enforcement agencies involved in the shooting death of Lavoie Finicum. It provided them with a justified, in scare quotes, use of deadly force alibi from a supposedly unassailable source, an eyewitness who was one of the occupation leaders and who therefore would not be disposed to provide testimony favorable to the FBI or unfavorable to his compatriots. Naturally, the established news media, which was overwhelmingly hostile toward the Hammond ranching family, the original objects of the occupier's support, and hostile as well toward the wildlife refuge occupation, ran with the McConnell video, in which McConnell said, among other things, that Finicum charged the officers, giving them no option but to shoot him out of fear for their own safety. That's something that was immediately and directly contradicted, not only by the other eyewitnesses, that is, by the people that actually witnessed the incident. By this time, McConnell was in custody. He could not have witnessed what happened at the roadblock more than a mile away. But it was also contradicted by the evidence that was provided by the videos. Which leads us to another interesting point about the imposition of gag order on Shauna Cox. Shauna Cox's video was consolidated with FBI video and released to the public when the 360-page investigation report was made public at the press conference. Shauna Cox has gone on record through that video describing what happened at the lethal roadblock on Highway 395. And now a gag order has been placed upon her because she has been saying exactly the same things in media interviews and other venues that the OSP itself and the Tri-County investigating team used as part of their press conference. If Mrs. Cox were to give an interview in which she said nothing more than what she had said in the video released by the government, she would be hauled away to jail and kept there indefinitely for criminal contempt of court. I reiterate, the purpose of that gag order is not to ensure due process. It's to silence somebody who's telling a truth that the government desperately wants to suppress. I'll be back in just a minute.
Frazier Glenn Cross is the man accused of killing those three people at a Jewish facility over the weekend. He was arrested. Frazier Glenn Miller, though, 30 years ago, testified right here at the Fort Smith Federal Courthouse against 14 other fellow white supremacists. Oh, yes, sir. The same man screaming Nazi slogans out of the back of a police car this weekend was once a witness in one of the lengthiest cases at the Fort Smith Federal Courthouse. The U.S. tried 14 known extremists for sedition, plotting to kill a federal judge and overthrow the U.S. government. Miller, a known white supremacist, testified during the trial in Fort Smith in 1988 while he was in prison on weapons charges. A U.S. attorney told the Associated Press then that Miller struck a plea deal, trading his testimony for a reduced sentence. All 14 were acquitted of those sedition charges. That same attorney also said Miller and his family would enter into the witness protection program after he was released from prison.
A federal judge has gagged Shauna Cox, almost certainly because she identified Mark McConnell as the FBI's informant during the protest occupation of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge in Harney County, Oregon. Anytime the federal government sets out to have a grand seditious conspiracy trial, there have been two in our history so far, they have to make use of somebody who is a planted informant or somebody who has been turned into becoming an informant for the FBI. What happens when the federal government sets out to protect an informant? A really useful case study, I think, is that of Glenn Miller, the improbably named informant that was the key witness at the 1988 Fort Smith sedition trial in Arkansas. In offering that as a potential parallel to what's happening with respect to the Bundy family, I'm not comparing the Bundy family in any way to leaders of the white supremacist movement, apart from the fact that they and people identified as their supporters and followers in the federal government's legal filings are looked upon as a threat to the legitimacy of the regime. At roughly the same time that the standoff was occurring near Bunkerville, Nevada, Glenn Miller murdered three people at two Jewish facilities in Kansas City. At the time, notes an article in the American Prospect by my old friend, no, he's not a friend, Chip Berlay. Chip Berlay is a professional self-appointed watchdog of right-wing extremism. At the time that Glenn Miller carried out that killing spree in April of 2014, wrote Berlay in the American Prospect, he was in the Federal Witness Protection Program. In a cautionary tale about the dubious wisdom of charging defendants of any political stripe with acts of sedition, Miller may have put one over on the feds some 25 years ago, relieving himself of a lengthy prison sentence that could have ultimately saved the lives lost at a Jewish community center and retirement community in Overland Park, Kansas. Already notorious as a white racist leader in the 1980s, Miller's long history of criminal activity on behalf of the white supremacist cause, note we're talking about criminal activity, not mere political agitation, led to his facing many years in prison until federal prosecutors offered him a plea deal in 1988 if he would testify at a sedition trial in Fort Smith, Arkansas, against his former Ku Klux Klan neo-Nazi and racist buddies. In the end, Miller's testimony was weak, some of it unbelievable, and the case ultimately collapsed, raising suspicions that he had duped federal officials. But a deal is a deal, and following his testimony and his release from prison, after serving 3 years of a five-year reduced sentence, Miller was given a new identity as Frazier Glenn Cross. What initially landed Miller in jail was his own transgression of a settlement won by the Southern Poverty Law Center. According to the SPLC, Miller is the former Grand Dragon of the Carolina Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, a group Miller founded. The group successfully sued Miller for operating an illegal paramilitary organization and using intimidation tactics against African Americans. Miller then formed the Klan-related White Patriot Party. Since this violated his court-supervised settlement in the SPLC lawsuit, Miller was found in criminal contempt and sentenced to 6 months in prison. And you will note how little that has to do with an actual offense. With his appeal pending, Miller tried to disappear underground, but the FBI caught up with him, finding him in Missouri with a cache of weapons. The Fort Smith case was built around charges of criminal, seditious conspiracy. The alleged conspiracy included plans to assassinate a federal judge and FBI agent as part of a broader plot to overthrow the federal government and establish a whites-only separatist nation in the Pacific Northwest. Note how quickly that theory of the case went from the specific to the abstract and almost cosmic. Two key government witnesses were white supremacists facing years in jail and trading testimony for concessions from the government. One was Miller, the other was a man named James Ellison. The plan by the alleged conspirators to set up a whites-only homeland was real, if quixotic. Less implausible, perhaps, were their alleged schemes for a series of murders, bombings, robberies, and other crimes to be carried out by groups and individuals in what was to be an informal white racist underground, loosely linked to the neo-Nazi Aryan Nations compound in Idaho, and other centers of white supremacist organizing and training. Anti-racist activist Leonard Ziskind, based in Kansas City, Missouri, had researched Miller and his allies for over three decades, and is the author of Blood and Politics, The History of the White Nationalist Movement from the Margins to the Mainstream. Ziskind told ABC News that Miller's testimony in the Fort Smith trial was extremely weak. Miller clearly disappointed the prosecutors, and some reports on Miller written during his interrogation by authorities prior to his being turned as an informant to testify in the Fort Smith trial reveal a credulous belief that Miller had renounced violence and bigotry. Steve Daniels, news anchor at the ABC affiliate WTVD in Raleigh, North Carolina, interviewed former federal prosecutor Doug McCullough, who was present during the initial interviews with Miller. ABC reporter James Hill revealed more details of the McCullough interview. Miller tried to be a little self-serving, McCullough said of Miller during the interview. Every defendant in those situations usually is at first, but he did open up about a lot of things about the White Patriot Party. He detailed a number of people that were involved in illegal activities that were his associates, and that's what we were looking for. In a series of ensuing interviews with federal and North Carolina investigators, Miller never denied his racist and anti-Semitic views, but claimed he had always denounced violence and illegal activity. Miller wanted nothing more to do with the movement, according to an FBI account of an interview in June of 1987. He was willing to turn his back on it in order to return to his family. His problem in the past had been intolerance linked with excessive drinking. This turned out not to be an accurate view, opines Mr. Berlay. What the federal prosecutors lacked in the Fort Smith trial was persuasive evidence linking those indicted to a sweeping conspiracy. Several of these people, as I pointed out, were already in jail on racketeering charges that had to do with discrete criminal acts, such as bank robbery or, in one instance, murder. Those individual crimes were not prosecuted because the federal government wanted to use an enterprise model under the RICO Act to criminalize a movement. And then in 1988, they wanted to charge these people and convict them again as part of a seditious conspiracy. Miller's testimony at the Fort Smith trial was so ludicrous that jurors rejected it and the case collapsed. The all-white jury, in every account I have read of this case, makes a point of referring to the ethnicity of the jury. In my opinion, this jury actually comported itself with commendable skepticism regarding the federal government's claims. And the problem with Miller's testimony was not that it was ludicrous on its face. The problem was that the federal government needed that type of ludicrous testimony to fit its ludicrous theory of the case. The all-white jury acquitted all 13 defendants, some of whom were already convicted and incarcerated for crimes, including the murder of Jewish talk show host Alan Berg in Denver. That crime, once again, was never prosecuted under Denver's homicide law because the federal government preempted that prosecution of the most serious crime you can commit in order to prosecute those involved in that murder for political crimes against the state. The prosecution's decision to use the sedition charge raises tough questions about civil liberties, bigotry, informers, and government repression. What happens when the government uses threats of decades in jail to turn a person into a handy informer who testifies against his former allies? Defense attorneys regularly complain that such witnesses are prone to embellishment, if not outright fabrication, in their testimony. That's because those witnesses are custom tailoring their testimony to the needs of the prosecution. Then there's the peril and suspicion of political intent when prosecutors wield the charge of sedition. The late constitutional rights attorney Arthur Kanoy told us he condemned the use of sedition charges by the government to attack all dissent, especially on the left. In the 1950s, Kanoy defended persons charged with communist sedition. Calling the views of the white supremacists in the Fort Smith case disgusting, Kanoy nonetheless said, "I'm worried about the charge of sedition against anyone." Civil liberties attorney Harvey A. Silverglade agreed, telling us, "I know it is a tricky and emotional issue, but sedition is a very serious charge, and to bring it in the Aryan Nations case at Fort Smith was patently absurd. You can't be cheering when the government brings a charge of sedition against the Aryan Nations crowd and then be complaining when they bring it against your friends. Today we condemn entrapment, paid informers, political grand juries, and dubious witnesses targeting left-wing anti-war protesters, environmental activists, anarchists, and others. Shouldn't we take the same position when the targets are on the political right, even for white supremacists? Every sedition trial depends upon informants and provocateurs." Shauna Cox identified an informant and provocateur from the Malheur Refuge protest, and so a federal judge has ordered her to shut up upon pain of criminal contempt charges that could leave her in prison in perpetuity. I reiterate, it is my suspicion that what's going to grow out of the Bunkerville and Malheur Refuge cases will be a seditious conspiracy trial that could result in hundreds being targeted for prosecution on account of their political beliefs, on account of political beliefs that have to do with the sanctity of private property and the need to free the land of the Western United States from federal control. Thank you for joining me this week on Freedom Zealot Radio. Please join me online at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. I'll be back with you again in a week, and until then, as always, doom spirito pugno, while I breathe, I fight. Good night, God bless, and maybe send the state back to the hell that spawned it.
What do you want to do now, Captain?
The same thing we always do. Fight them until we can't.
Brothers, fight or fall. It's man for man and one for all. No more can we crawl.